This is Jessica Taylor. It is September 26th, 27th, 2018, and I'm here with Michael Ogle at Zoom Knoxville. And sir, can you please state your full name?
My full name is Ronnie Michael Ogle II.
Oh my gosh.
Okay. Yes. It's quite the name.
And where were you born?
I was born in Greensboro, North Carolina.
Okay. Where'd you grow up?
From the age of 5 on, I've been in Knoxville, except for my 8th grade when I lived in Nashville.
Okay. Awesome. And what are your earliest memories of being outside in this region?
Oh, gosh. I would say probably, I don't have the greatest memory in the world, sadly, but probably when I was about 3 or 4, my grandfather, as I call him, my papaw, in Sevierville, so my dad was raised in Ware's Valley, and they still had their property there, and they lived there until he passed. But yeah, he would take me out up into the mountain. Their house went straight up into the mountain. So yeah, we'd go looking around. I don't remember seeing a whole heck of a lot or remembering a whole great details, but that is what I pseudo remember what my parents have told me my first experiences out in this region would be.
Mm-hmm. And what was your papa like? Did he do stuff with you outside? Did he teach you things?
Yeah, I mean, he unfortunately passed right before I turned 5. So, but yeah, no, he was definitely a man of the land. He was a farmer, and you know, he was always out. He was more comfortable out doing those sort of things than being indoors, for sure.
Okay. And what did your dad teach you about being outside?
So he, you know, being raised in, obviously, by his father, he was definitely an outdoorsman as well. You know, we would go looking, you know, from my grandmother continued to live in that same house until I was probably about 13 or 14. And so when we would go on our, you know, about every other weekend visit to visit her in Sevierville, you know, we would customarily go up into the mountains just looking for, you know, whatever we could see. And then she lived next to the creek there, and so we would go down looking for turtles and water snakes and things like that. And she had a little spring on her property, and I definitely remember seeing spring salamanders there, just because they were, you know, kind of a bright orange coloration. So that's that's an easy one to stick in my memory. I'm sure there were other salamanders as well, but not, you know, the Desmognathus aren't nearly as the dusky salamanders are. They're dusky. They're not very colorful, so I don't remember all of those. But no, I remember that, and I remember being in her driveway and finding a baby ringneck snake when I was little. Those are definitely memories that I still have. And so, unfortunately, as we got older, my dad got a really bad back and couldn't go out as much. But then, you know, once I was able to drive myself. Going to look for salamanders and other things here in the mountains were something I could easily do and did on my own and still do to this day. And we try to instill that in the children that I now have. So it's tougher I'm sure I was a lazy kid that enjoyed TV, but as you know, as they get older or as you know, in this generation, it's even tougher because everyone's got a phone and all that. So.
Sure, yeah. When you went looking for salamanders in the creeks and things like that,
yeah.
Where would you go? What kind of things would you look to indicate that, like, this was a stream that would have salamanders in it?
Well, you mean when I was real young or when more in high school and slightly older?
More in high school.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, you know, basically everyone had kind of the Peterson's Field Guide to Reptiles and Amphibians and I'll be honest, you know, it was mostly just going out and looking and not always knowing exactly what would be the best area to find something. You know, there were plenty of times I'd get skunked and see absolutely nothing. But as I was finishing up high school and just starting college is when I started volunteering here at the zoo. And the keepers that were here, you know, we would go out. Any time during the spring, summer, and fall is any evening you can usually find at least something. But, you know, going out on rainy nights You know, I remember going up to the chimney picnic loop up in the Smoky Mountains, and you could see, you know, 30 to 40 red-cheek salamanders, the Jordan salamanders, the most famous salamander here in the park. And, you know, it's just one of those crazy things. And because there's such diversity in salamanders in the area, you know, you would just kind of look and try to find, like, oh, I want to see this species this week or something like that. And I, multiple trips I would take up to with Tommy Owens, who used to work here, up to Boone, North Carolina. That Watauga County up there is supposedly the greatest diversity of salamanders are found there. And more than multiple occasions, we wouldn't get back home until 3 a.m. and then had to be at work at 8. And thankfully, I was much younger then. I don't think I could do that anymore. I'm just too old. But that was where I found, you know, there were plenty of times where we would go looking for hellbenders in the national park. And for whatever reason, we just always didn't, we were unable to find them. But we made a contact with Dr. Wayne Van Deventer at Appalachian State, who's like the god of salamanders here in the Southeast. And he's like, oh, just come up and visit me, and I can guarantee that we can find some. And we're like, okay. And so we, you know, it was one of those late night trips where we, you know, we got up to Boone around 8 or 9 in the evening. We go out with him. He takes us to this beautiful creek, and he's like, "All right, we'll probably find one." And I remember before I even turned my flashlight on, I had accidentally kicked one. I just stepped into the creek. I didn't know it, and I was like, "What is that?" And I look down, and it's probably a foot and a half long hellbender, and that was my first hellbender, and that's. That's about as good as it gets right there. And I remember that night. I always remember that night because we found, I think it was amongst the four of us, we found, I think, 17 that evening. I mean, it was just one of those magical nights of hellbenders. And so, you know, that really kind of fueled my interest even more in that species. And you know, through chatting with folks here in East Tennessee, we kind of learned about the Hiawassee River being this great area for hellbenders. And so Phil Cockliffe, who's the director of animal collections here, kind of got a hellbender monitoring project and looking for various pathogens and diseases that they can carry. And so him and Dr. Souza, veterinarian at the vet school, you know, we'd go out with them and do snorkel surveys. And, you know, every time you flip a rock, and it's never not an amazing sight when you flip a rock or you just happen to see one out cruising around and you see this foot-long aquatic salamander, just, you know, just with his tiny little beady eyes. You know, Phil likes to make the joke, due to my inbreeding here in East Tennessee, it's why I have the same beady eyes as a hellbender. Maybe that's true. Maybe that's why I feel this appreciation for the snot otter. But yeah, I mean, it's every time you flip a rock. And even that, like, I went out this past summer a couple times in my life, and every time you flip a rock and there's a hellbender, it's just, you're like, wow, how is that animal here? And how did this many people not know about it and appreciate it? I mean, I understand maybe being nervous if you were to spy one the first time. You're like, whoa, what is that? But, I mean, it's just something that you don't expect to have in the United States. You know, it should be some faraway, cool critter that you've got to travel half the world to see. And you know, obviously there are the other species are much larger in Japan and China, but to me, the hellbenders is about as good as it gets. So,
yeah.
Yeah.
Did your parents or grandparents ever tell you anything about them?
No, because for whatever reason, the creek that was that runs by my where my dad grew up and where my grandparents were, it should have been, and at one point it would have been ideal habitat for hellbenders, but I think even in the 1950s and 60s when my dad was growing up, I think the water had already been turned, and he never saw one ever. And I've taken him to the Hiawassee to see them, but yeah, I know they, for whatever happens in the Sugar Bowl with water pollution, they just weren't there. So he was not familiar with them, unfortunately, but You know, I mean, he read about them in books, but he'd never seen one until he was, you know, an adult and a grandpa, and I took him out to the Hiawassee to see one, unfortunately. So, yeah, no, there's, I don't have any, I wish I had some cool local stories like that, but sadly I don't.
Yeah. Well, what did your dad say when you took him to see the Hellbenders on the Hiawassee?
I mean, he was just, you know, he was the same as me, just kind of awestruck that this animal is here, and that you obviously have to have healthy water ecosystem for that species to be able to persist. And so it's sad that we have what supposedly looks like such clean water around here, but there are so few areas where you can still find the hellbender, or other aquatic salamanders like mud puppies and things like that. And so yeah, no, he was, even though sadly my dad is a Trump supporter, there's still a little bit of good in him.
Well, speaking of, you know, causing the water to turn, what's the sure. biggest or series of biggest threats to hellbender habitat?
I think to me, I think a lot of the damage, at least in East Tennessee, has been done, and we're trying to reverse it. And, you know, there are folks like Conservation Fisheries that are trying to restore a lot of these really endangered darters and other fish. And at some points, and zoos have started doing this a bit, not so much here in East Tennessee yet, where they are repatriating hellbenders to where they were found. And, you know, basically we need a conservation hellbender that is going to do that. And, you know, I think that the still current threats to them are primarily probably increased siltation and agricultural runoff. I don't know if you've had the opportunity to go to the Hiawassee, but you definitely should. It is one of the most beautiful scenic rivers. I think it's officially labeled as a scenic river, and there's not that many of them in the United States. But it is just a beautiful place to see. But there's farmland there, so we know that there's most likely pesticides running off into the water. So I would say that are the primary problems in just the, you know, it's just trying to keep the water clean and trying to bring them back. But we recently found out, I guess it was last year, I attended the Hellbender Symposium. It's a meeting that occurs about every other year. And for whatever reason, it was in Jackson, Mississippi last year, which is nowhere near where hellbenders are found. And it looks like genetically there are I think a minimum of 4 different species of hellbenders now. So we're now going to have to be careful about make sure once we get to that restocking that we're restocking the right species. So I think North Carolina is going to have 3 species. Tennessee at least has 2. So it's that's great work to know. And you know, when you look at it, like if you catch a hellbender in the Hiawassee River. A large one's about 15 inches or so, but those big ones that I was finding at Appalachian State and Boone, they were closer to 20 inches. And then when we see the genetics that they ran at, I think it was the University of Kentucky, they're 2 different species. So now it makes sense as to why one was significantly smaller than not only in length but also just in mass. It was just they're just tremendously smaller than the Hiawassee. And you know, it's a large river, there's plenty of food, so but you know, they just that species is adapted to being a slightly much smaller size. So yeah, it's just an amazing species that we have to preserve. Amazing species now, I guess, that we have to preserve, and we're hopeful that we can help contribute with that and to mud puppy conservation, which is a St. Patrick species that lives with the hellbender. They're known as the common mud puppy, but what we're finding in Tennessee is that they're not so common. There's very few of them. When people do like Conservation Fisheries do their surveys, when hellbender people do their surveys, you just don't find that many hellbenders. You might find 5 to 10 hellbenders before you find your first mud puppy. So just looking at all that and just trying to make sure the rivers are healthy for everybody is a lofty goal, especially down here in the South where environmental laws aren't as well regarded.
Well, what would you like to see change in the future? And, like, what's the problem that's stopping us from having better or more stringent environmental laws?
I mean, that's a good question. When you talk to local folks, they understand the need for clean water, but it's also getting them to change their practices. So, you know, the farmer has always done this pesticide product, always has, probably always will, unless they just make it just completely gone from the market. And I think it's just that education, and you clearly know this better than I. You got to start them when they're young. You know, you've got to do that community outreach, and not every school is as good as every other school, and so those kids don't get that. And at home, they're just taught that, you know, those animals are just for us to do whatever we want with, and it doesn't matter. So it's I feel like it's very ingrained. That sort of mentality that's going to be tough to do, but I know that it can be done. It's not going to happen overnight, but getting people to be aware of the bigger world, and not everyone gets to travel, but I think when folks get to travel and see this is a big world, it's not just this little region that we live in, that you get to appreciate it. I was just at a conference in Seattle a couple of days ago, and obviously Seattle's a very big town, but just the amount of they're willing to pay taxes to help the environment, and that's down here in the South we're hesitant about paying any extra money for anything. But so I think it's just that conservative mindset, and there's certainly not wrong with having a conservative mindset on certain matters, and everyone's got to work together. But I think overall the country's just kind of divided, and everyone's kind of got their line in the sand, and we've got to find that bridge to kind of bring folks back together to have some common sense to realize that, hey, clean water for animals is clean water for us, and maybe we don't need all these pesticides in our food, because who knows what it does to us. I'm not nearly educated enough to tell you something, about that. But I think it just takes time. But I think changing the mentality is the most important thing.
Okay. Not naming any names or anything.
Sure.
But do you have any personal experience with myth busting, having conversations with property owners?
Sure. When you're out in the rivers, either in the Smoky Mountains or at the Hiawassee River, you run into fishermen. You just run into local folks that are they're asking, why are you in a wetsuit with a mask on? What are you What are you possibly doing? Why are you doing this? If you can find a help vendor, you'll say, well, this is what we're doing. And nine times out of 10, they had no earthly idea that creature even existed. So you try to build up that, you get past that shock and awe of seeing this giant aquatic salamander. Then it goes into the, while they can bite, they don't, they're not going to bite your toes. They're not out to, to do things like that. Customarily also run into a lot of fishermen, and you say they will eat small fish, but their primary, the majority of their diet is crayfish. It's they're not after your the animals that you are here for. And I try not to say it, but generally their animals, the fish that are stocked for fishermen, have a very serious impact on hellbenders and the native animals that are there. So, finding that mix of where folks can have that, because I realize that we always hear from the Tennessee Wildlife Resources Agency, non-game research is paid for by game, so the folks that buy their deer hunting license and their fishing license, that's, so you got to have that blend. So I in a perfect world, of course you wouldn't, people would just want to fund and support things for the sake of it. We're not in a perfect world, we've got a so it's just trying to educate them and show them. But I've never had anyone, say they have killed one. The worst I've heard is, you know, they've had to remove a hook from them when the hellbender accidentally grabbed the prey item, but it was on the hook. But fortunately, I have not run into the into near the amount of disdain or hatred that I do for when I'm looking for snakes, because, you know, 9 times out of 10, the only good snake's a dead snake when I run into people. So when I'm out looking for snakes, but yeah, it's just educating them about that this truly unique creature exists in our own backyard, and it's up to us, along with so many other folks, to try to keep them safe and keep them going.
I had, just as an aside, have you heard about where the name came from, the origin of the name snot otter or hellbender?
Snot otter is an easy one. I will tell you, I'll just say the two stories that I've heard, whether or not they're true, is, snot otter is just, it's just kind of read about it that, you know, people would pick them up and their slime, their protective coat, they just squeeze straight out of your hands. And I remember the first one I grabbed, I did not have a firm grip on it. It shot out like a snot. I clearly get that one. And the other one that I've heard, about the name hellbender is that, the people would be out flipping rocks and they would see this mythical demonic creature, and that it was clearly from hell and it was going to try to suck you down into it. That's what I've read. I've never heard anyone, truly say that, but so I have no earthly idea if that's true or not, but those are the two stories that I've heard regarding those. So
okay.
Yeah. So I don't know if they match up with what you've heard from other folks, but
I really haven't heard a lot, and I'm wondering if it comes from a different region, maybe like New York or something.
I wanna say that when I read about Hellbender, it was either Pennsylvania or New York. It was one of the two. So so you might have to go north for that one. So
one of the things that Jerry talked about yesterday was like the distinction people make between game and non-game
mm-hmm.
animals.
Yeah.
Do you find that with the public at the zoo or in your research, that they think about useful and non-useful animals in different ways?
Yes. I would say that for the most part, people only really think about the game. You know, it's either these fish are here for us to fish, and we're glad that they put them in at such and such rate per year, and that they have established populations, and the deer, and, you know, people should not, you know, we need less coyotes. We definitely don't want red wolves because, you know, they'll eat all the deer, and we need the deer. And then you drive around, like in my neighborhood this morning, I saw 3 deer running through my neighborhood. I'm like, maybe a predator would be okay. So, or if you ever take, just the most that you can think of for game animals is driving through Cades Cove in the national park, and just the insanity of people stopping every 13 seconds when they see a deer. And it's like, good grief, people, this is... Because when I go there, I'm looking for salamanders. And I'm like, could you just get out of my way? I've got my two spots I like to go to. So, yeah, no, I think there is that clear distinction. I think they think about game, and I think for the most part, they don't think about non-game. That's my perception, that they just don't even consider that as anything to even worry about.
Okay.
So.
Another distinction I was thinking about is animals people are afraid of
mm-hmm.
and animals they're not,
yeah.
Particularly like reptiles and amphibians.
Sure. Yeah.
Do you have a sense of like specific to this region
mm-hmm.
where that come from, what the reasoning is there?
I will say, from an amphibian standpoint, not typically so much. I mean, when I've shown folks maybe their first hellbender, they are, they're immediately kind of stunned of something of that size. But no, with reptiles, it's easy. They, you could even see like they think the five-line skinks, that are very common around everywhere with their blue tails. They think those are toxic and they're out to get you. You try to have a rational conversation, but at some point you immediately just kind of want to beat your head into a wall. Because you're like, what? Why would you think that? But snakes, oh gosh. I mean, it is so, it is so ingrained. It's just what they're taught. You know, it to me, it clearly goes back to the Bible. You know, folks just have that just natural fear of snakes. I think it's taught. And, you know, evolutionarily speaking, you get why there is that concern. And, you know, I've read a couple papers that human vision has to thank the snake, you know, that folks when, you know, back in Africa when our species was developing, you know, there are a lot of deadly venomous snakes there. And that kind of, the ones that could see them, I guess, were selected for and they were able to pass on their genes. So we should be thankful of snakes while we can see so well. But no, I mean, the amount of just a couple of weeks ago, I went to I gave a talk at the local Sertoma group, and it was about snakes and why they should appreciate them. And I was pleased that I only had one person say that every time they see a snake, they, you know, they immediately run it over and then they reverse to make sure that they got it. I was surprised that it was only one out of the 15 that were there, because usually we get that from, you know, two-thirds, or not two-thirds, maybe a third to a half, depending on who we're speaking with. But yeah, just the overwhelming mentality that is the only good snake is a dead snake is something that is hard to fight. And, you know, when we try, you know, we have keeper chats where we just take out, you know, corn snakes just to show them this is what our local snake is. They're common. A lot of folks think they're copperheads, and they're not. And you know, everyone, another very common concern in the national park is, everyone thinks we have cottonmouths, which is a venomous snake. We don't have them. They're, you know, the closest you're going to get to them is about 45 minutes west of Nashville. We just don't have the habitat that the cottonmouth prefers, but everyone that sees a water snake thinks that it's a cottonmouth and they go out of their way to kill it. So you try to tell them, hey, one, you shouldn't kill snakes. Two, it's against the law. Three, it's really against the law when you do it in the national park. But it's just so ingrained. And it's weird. I haven't spent a lot of time out west, but, you know, when I've been out west looking for snakes, you know, on vacation and things like that, people who have, you know, in the state of Arizona, I believe there's 11 species of rattlesnake. In some places, rattlesnakes are in your backyard. It's just a thing. They seem to handle it better out there than we do in East Tennessee, where the venomous snakes are primarily restricted to either the plateau or the national park, and they're not very common, unfortunately. You know, we've truly decimated those species. And it's just weird that they have a better grasp, even though they deal with it more frequently than we do. So a lot of it, of course, this goes back to education, and you got to teach them. And we try, and our zoo education department, they go out of their way to try. It's a long process that will never be completed. But if you don't try, then what's the point? So,
You mentioned the Park Service. What's the role of recreation and tourism in either, you know, helping stream quality and education or hurting it?
I think it's a mixture of both. I mean, you've got to educate folks about it. So you need them to come see the habitat and potentially see the animal. But at the same time, there's so much tourism. I think I read somewhere the other day that 11 million visitors visited the national park last year. I mean, as great as that is also a lot of cars. That's a lot of pollution that's going into it. I have seen a recent influx because just this simple little thing, you know, a lot of folks, when they go to these creeks and streams, they like to make those little man-made dams where they just stack rocks. And I swear to God, I guess they kind of like to do it, but we always make sure that we immediately take them down when we leave, and I won't let the kids leave without doing it. But so many people do that and then they just leave. And just that little thing can divert. One, you're taking away areas for the salamanders depend on to hide under, so you're taking away habitat. So it's just simple things like that. But I recently have started seeing signs like, please don't do this. This is illegal. Don't do this. That is great. And again, you're not going to reach all of them, but as long as we pick up one kid each time, maybe, that does it, then we've got help for the future. But yeah, it's simple things like not doing that and then just not taking rocks. A lot of people will just go into the park and just take rocks out of the river because they're nice decorative rocks and they don't want to pay, you know, however much it costs at you know, Home Depot or whatever for rocks. So it's like, people don't steal the damn rocks. So, but they do it. So, yeah, I see it as with everything, it's a hindrance, it's a burden, but it's also, we have to do it. So you gotta continue educating them once you get them there into the habitat, to appreciate the animal. But, again, it's just that uphill struggle.
In terms of your research, you were doing the hellbender monitoring. What did you guys find?
The Hiwassee River is, for whatever reason, even though it does have some areas of pollution and things like that, that it is overall, it is very healthy. And the hellbender population there is doing rather well. I don't know how much of this is just hearsay or is maybe actually true, but I've heard that Western North Carolina populations and the Hiwassee River populations are one of the main reasons that hellbenders have not been federally listed, because they are still relatively secure. So if that is true, that is still kind of sad because the hellbender has such a larger range, and if they're not doing well elsewhere, maybe we should not be focused just on Western North Carolina and parts of Eastern Tennessee. But you find all age classes in the Hiwassee River. You'll find the youngins all the way up to the adults, and to a much lesser degree you'll find that in the Little River as well. But the pigeon is where the so much pollution happened, and that's where there still needs to be additional conservation efforts for bringing the hellbender back to that area. But but yeah, I know overall the hellbender is doing pretty well in the Hiwassee, which is great, but we just need that everywhere. And, you know, and it's just going to take time to get them back to those numbers, and hopefully we can.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Last question. Yeah. What are your hopes for future research, big gaps, and future conservation big gaps?
Sure. Yeah. So I think zoos overall, zoos have a... Our role is changing from just pure entertainment to trying to have that conservation, real, actual, on-the-ground conservation efforts. And I think zoos can help with education of that by showing guests, you know, letting them appreciate what these animals are. But we also can play a role in, head starting. So, there are several zoos that have either collected nests or they figured out how to breed them in captivity. And then they raise up the youngsters until they're at a slightly larger size, and then they can take them back to the wild. So I think using biosecure methods where we don't just, we wear special clothing and we make sure that we're not bringing in diseases and pathogens from other places. So I think that is the main role that I see zoos and potentially Knoxville helping with in the future, is trying to maybe help restock those areas. That are in great conservation need, and currently the Chattanooga Zoo and Nashville Zoo are leading the efforts for our state in doing that. But we here at Knoxville, Stephen Nelson, my keeper that works for my lead keeper, he's really on doing the project with the mud puppies, and so I think we'll also have a role in trying to breed that species maybe for reintroduction as well. I think that's the best spot for zoos really to do, from, educating the public about the animals. Because we do, they always say more folks visit zoos than attend all major sporting events in the United States. So we have a very large audience. It's just getting, one, their focus, and two, making sure, there's still got to be a little bit of entertainment too. I mean, it's hard to do entertainment for a hellbender, but, you want to have a nice, you want to have a nice naturalistic exhibit and kind of explain the animal. So it's finding that mix of education and exciting stuff that we can really, get the message in, and maybe hopefully eventually we could have certain school groups where we take them, out to see these animals in the wild and even get a better appreciation for that. So that would be kind of my lofty goals for us into the future. But we're always happy to assist with any research project in the area. There's usually folks from various universities doing stuff, and if they ever need extra hands, we always were like, yeah, sure. Well, who doesn't want to go out snorkeling all day? And I mean, sometimes it's a little cold, but it's all right. It's fun.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Anything else you'd like to add, or no?
I don't think so. Hopefully I gave you some good answers.
Oh, definitely.
Okay.
Hold on, just a second.
Hopefully I didn't move too much. I'm sorry.
No.